I was thinking about her again just the other day. See, the thing is, when you're a pastor, you spend a lot of time with people who are in crisis, people whose pain is overwhelming, and they affect you. They leave their mark. And when, as a pastor, you leave that congregation, you don't just forget them or their stories. They take up sort of a permanent residence in your soul, and you carry them with you, and they push their way to the front of your consciousness from time to time. And that happened, I don't know, about a week or so ago with a woman whose name was Anne. And she and her husband, Bob, had found their way into our congregation when we were in Massachusetts. And they were regulars as soon as they started attending, and they joined a small group Bible study that I was teaching, and their lives were open wounds. As she spent time in our study, Anne's story gradually unfolded. She'd been raped when she was younger, and the pain, like acid, had seared her soul permanently. And their adult daughter suffered from anorexia. At the time, she was hospitalized. She weighed about 70 pounds. And for all their love and for all they had tried to do to help, Anne and Bob could not do much more other than sit beside her bed and dread the moment when her body would finally give up. Then Bob lost his job. And the economy at the time offered little promise of finding another. And right about that same time, a monster nor'easter hit. That's a New England version of a hurricane. It was the storm that the movie The Perfect Storm a few years ago was about. We lived on the beach at the time. I saw huge sailboats thrown up onto shore, laying on their sides with giant holes punched in their hulls. Anne and Bob lived on the beach too, and their home was lost in the storm. If ever I have met a living, breathing Job, Anne was as close to that person as I'm probably ever going to find. And we listened to Anne in our study, and we prayed for her, and we wept for her, and we surrounded her, and we struggled with God right alongside of her. And in the end, she finally left our study, and she left the church, and she left her faith. The pain was too deep. The hurt was too great. Her inability to reconcile a loving God with the constant drumbeat of suffering that she had endured for so long created this dissonance that she could no longer endure. It was all too much. And so she gave up. She walked away. She went in search of an alternative spirituality. And part of me, to tell you the truth, understands that. I think maybe you do too. Because I think a lot of us have been in some kind of similar place when it feels like we just can't take any more. And all the tried and true answers trotted out by well-meaning friends to explain why this is happening and to protect the integrity of a God who is conspicuously silent and sitting on his hands sound like just so much incoherent babbling to us, or worse. And I've always wondered what I didn't give Anne that I should have, or what I didn't do that I could have, or what resources I might have supplied that I might have helped. Now, I know, of course, that she was ultimately responsible for her own choice, not me. But still, for a pastor, and I think for any Christian, I'm not sure there's anything quite as heartbreaking as witnessing someone give up on faith, especially if it's someone you love. They take a part of your soul with them, leaving something of this permanent fracture, this scar where their faith used to be. Now, our series theme these last couple of weeks has been fragile faith. And we've been talking about that, and will for a couple more weeks, because I think faith in times of difficulty and trouble and heartache and suffering is the very most difficult thing any of us ever deal with. I mean, it's hard. And we've been looking over the last few weeks at how there are times when it feels as life is going to break you, and at those times, faith can become tenuous and vulnerable, or like with Anne, disappear entirely. And what you thought you knew about God doesn't seem to work anymore. And we looked at Joseph's story and how God's plan sometimes involves a lot of twists and turns along the way. And we talked last week about Job and the question of why God isn't fair. And today I want to spend some time looking at how we navigate those times, how we make it through the 86,400 seconds of today, much less tomorrow or next week or next month or next year. What's the plan for holding on to faith when you don't even have the strength to hold on to your sanity or to hold on to your hope or to hold on to anything at all? Now, pain does a funny thing to us. When it shows up, all we want to do is be rid of it as quickly as possible. Better yet, we want to avoid it entirely. That's what we spend a lot of our time and energy and money and interest on each and every day, how to avoid pain. But when it shows up, we at least want to make it go away. Because pain, we don't like it. We don't want it around. I used to go to the gym, but I stopped. You want to know why? Because all their machines involve a whole lot of pain and not much fun. I mean, think about it. You can run in place until your legs hurt and your lungs burn and you feel like you're going to throw up. And if you're really a masochist, you can watch the view on the monitor while you're at it, which just adds to the pain. No, thank you. You can cycle and have gallons of sweat roll off you while someone berates you for not going fast enough. And at the end, you won't have traveled an inch. I looked around one day for an exercise machine where I could just like lie down, take a nap. Machine's going to move my body around, burn some calories, and whisper to me about how amazing I look. Okay. Couldn't find it. Apparently no such machine exists. So nowadays, I just ride my bike outside because at least you get to go places and see things and feel the sun on your skin, or I go for a walk because there aren't any sweat factories next to me flashing their abs. Okay. The thing is, I like pain. We want a life without pain. We kind of hope that maybe God will provide that. It's kind of his job, right? And we get disappointed when that doesn't happen. But maybe we shouldn't expect to avoid it. Because Jesus makes something pretty clear in today's reading. To quote him directly, "In this world, you will have trouble." Now notice, he did not say, "You might have trouble." He did not say you could have a little bit of discomfort, possibly, maybe, and then it will go away. No, he says you're going to have trouble because this is a troubled, broken, sinful planet on which you live, a messed up, unpleasant place sometimes, and you're part of it, and what's more, you have a hand in it, and you're going to get caught up in it, and you're going to get touched by it. And the sin that wrecks everything around you lives in you just as surely as the blood flows through your veins. In this world, you're going to have trouble. Now, Jesus says this on the night of his Last Supper. Yeah, I don't think he's really got this whole idea of light dinner conversation down very well. Okay? Because he's just been talking with his friends about what is coming up, about how he's going to be leaving them to go back to his Father. And how the world is going to hate them for being his followers. And in a few more minutes, he's going to pray for them, and then they're all going to head out together to the Garden of Gethsemane, and all the horror the next 24 hours is going to bring. So you could say, I guess, that Jesus is being brutally honest with them. If you live in this world, you can expect pain. And just because you belong to me, he says, doesn't somehow protect you or inoculate you from it. And it may, in fact, make it worse. Expect it. Don't be surprised by it. So what we really need to know is we need to know how to function when it comes, because it will. How to endure it when it comes, because it will. How to live through it. And more than that, how to hold on to our faith while we wait for God to do what God's going to do. And maybe even how it might be possible for faith to thrive and deepen amid the inevitable troubles of life. Because that's his promise here this morning. He says not only, in this world you will have trouble, but he follows it up with, take heart. I've overcome the world. And that's our key. Because there's a whole lot of bad advice out there, and you've probably heard it all, and you maybe have said some of it. And some of it may have elements of truth in it, but spoken or heard at the wrong time, it can just feel cruel. For instance, your life has fallen apart, and someone says to you, well, God won't give you more than you can handle. Don't you just want to punch them in the face when they say that? Huh? You can. It's okay. Don't ever say that. Don't ever say that to anyone. God will give you more than you can handle. That's not good news. Because I'm suffering and I hear you say that, but I know I'm not handling this right now at all. So does that mean I'm a bad Christian? I'm failing in every conceivable way. Does that mean that I don't have enough faith? Worse yet, is God going to give me more just to find out what my breaking point is? And besides, shouldn't it be that God won't give me more than he can handle? And then there's this one. Others have it so much worse. I bet you've said that, haven't you? Usually about yourself. Well, others have so much worse than me. Well, can I just say it's not a competition, okay? My pain doesn't become less just because someone else is suffering more. You got to remember the context here because it's crucial to what Jesus is saying. You can't get the full depth of what Jesus is after here without taking seriously when he is saying it. Jesus is preparing to go and die. He's in the final hours before he's going to be arrested and beaten and nailed to the cross and suffocate for the sins of the world, including yours and mine. And he's telling his friends that they can expect that the road ahead is going to be unimaginably painful, not just for him, but for them too. He is not promising them safety. He is promising them life. That's two different things. He is not offering them freedom from pain. He is offering them a hope to hold on to in the middle of it. See, because here's a secret. It's a mystery. It's something that goes against everything that we think is right. Okay. If you turn away from the pain, if you run from it, as Peter himself will later that night, while nursing the idea that this should never have happened to you in the first place, then you deny God the chance to show you the greatest mystery of all, and it's this, that there, right there, in the worst of moments and the darkest shadow of your deepest pain and the creeping despair of your fear, it's right there that you find the door to abundant life. It's hardly ever found amid sunshine and rainbows and unicorns. Because when you're in that spot, you're good, all on your own. The door to abundant life is most often found when menacing clouds gather and rain comes down. Don't run away from it. Because no one is asking you to handle it alone. Your faith is not dependent on how successfully you endure that suffering. Your faith is dependent on the fact that Christ did. Because by allowing it to destroy him, he destroyed our identity as people enslaved by the madness of this world and enslaved by the sin that entangles us and captive to everything evil and contrary to who God is. It destroyed him so he could destroy that. And his promise that night to his disciples was just this. The cross was not going to be the end of the story. After he suffered and died, he would rise again. The suffering and the pain and the death that he endured would not overcome him. And because it could not overcome him, it would not overcome them or us. So what we do is we hold on to him. And we look to him, and we cling to him, and we fix our eyes on him, because hope is not based on identifying the right options for getting ourselves to a better place. And hope is not dependent on figuring out correctly where we go from here. And hope is not trusting the right plan. It's trusting the right person, the one who has overcome the world. And if he could overcome the suffering and the sin and the death, isn't it possible that he can also overcome the pain and the hurt and the sadness that's made its home in you? When trite words and well-meaning antidotes fall short, when we have no strength left to hold on, we rest in the sacred, scarred hands of the God who has borne our sorrows and carried our grief. And in the meantime, what we need is some fighting words. No general would send his troops into battle unprepared. No coach would send her team onto the field ill-equipped. No teacher would send their students into the testing room without giving them the resources that they need. And neither has God left you high and dry. So here you go, some fighting words for when you're being poured out, caught off guard, and your fingers feel like they're about to give way while you dangle on the side of a cliff. Now, I only have the time to give you a few because there are lots, lots, lots more in the Bible. You can write these ones down if you want, look them up, read them a little bit later. Romans 5. Romans 5, and we boast in the hope of the glory of God, not only so, but we also glory in our sufferings, because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance character, and character hope, and hope does not put us to shame, because God's love has been poured out into our hearts through the Holy Spirit who has been given to us. How about this one? 1 Peter 5:10. After we suffered a little while, the God of all grace, who's called us to his eternal glory in Christ, will himself restore, confirm, strengthen, and establish us. Jesus will wipe away every tear from our eyes. Death will be no more. That's what Revelation 21:4 says. There will be no more mourning, no more crying, no more pain, because suffering, troubles, and death, these things will all pass away. Come to me, Jesus says in Matthew 11:28, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Psalm 138:7, though I walk in the midst of trouble, you preserve my life. With your right hand, you save me. 2 Corinthians 4:17, for our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. Lamentations 3:21-23. Yet this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. Because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed, for his compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. Those are just a few of the fighting words with which God has supplied you. The resource you need for the hope he gives, the world words that you can hurl against the darkness. Because he wants so much more for you than to simply survive today's 86,000 seconds. Yeah, we're going to have trouble in this world. But Christ has overcome the world. And so our suffering will never, ever define us. Our brokenness is no longer our identity. Christ has become our identity. His victory is what defines us. His story is our story, including its never-ending glory.